January the 11th, creation. We continue in Parshas Vayishlach on page 190. Last time, which was already several weeks ago, we spoke about Kever Rachel and Rachel being buried not in the Maaseh Machpelah. And now we're up to Pasuk Chaf Aleph 21 on page 190. And we're going to have just a few psukim here, which are very difficult to understand. Vayisa Yisrael, and Yisrael traveled. Vayet Ahalo, and he pitched his tent. Mehala L'Migdal Eder, beyond Migdal Eder. It translated as, beyond Migdal Eder. Migdal Eder is a place. So he pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. That's already a red flag. Beyond Migdal Eder. Well, where was it? It was beyond Migdal Eder. Vayihi bishkon Yisrael baratahi, and it was when Yisrael dwelled in that place, in that land. Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went. Vayishkav es Bilha pileges aviv, and he lived with Bilha, the concubine of his father. Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael heard. Vayu v'nei Yaakov shnei masar, and the children of Yaakov were 12. B'nei Leah, the sons of Leah, Bechor Yaakov Reuven, the firstborn of Yaakov was Reuven, V'Shimon V'Levi V'Yehuda, V'Yisachar U'Zevulun. So there's your six sons of Leah. B'nei Rachel, Yosef U'Binyamin. The sons of Rachel were Yosef and Binyamin. U'Bnei Bilha Shivchas Rachel, and the sons of Bilha, the maid of Rachel, Dan V'Naphtali. U'Bnei Zilpa Shivchas Leah, God V'Asher. And the sons of Zilpah, the Shivcha of Leah, the maid of Leah, were God and Asher. Ela ben Yaakov, these are the sons of Yaakov, Ashiyud Lalo b'Padan Aram, that were born to him in Padan Aram. And the next pasuk will be Yaakov actually getting to Yitzchak. Let's read that as well. We'll read a little bit further. Vayavo Yaakov al Yitzchak Aviv, and Yaakov came to Yitzchak his father, Mamre Kiryas Ha'arba, to Mamre Kiryas Arba. He Chevron, which is Chevron. Those are all the names of Chevron. Mamre Kiryas Arba, which is Chevron. Asher Gar Sham Abraham Yitzchak, that Abraham and Yitzchak sojourned there. Vayu Yime Yitzchak, and the days of Yitzchak were Maas Shana Ushmonim Shana, 180 years. Vayigva Yitzchak Vayamas, and Yitzchak, they translate as expired, and he died. It makes you wonder, what is the difference between expiring and dying? Vayigva Yitzchak Vayamas, Vayayasef Al Hamav, he was gathered into his nation, Zaken Usva Yamim, old and satiated of days, Vayikveru Oso Esav V'Yaakov Banav, and he was buried by Esav and Yaakov, his sons. The story of Reuven here is both tragic and also misunderstood. What did Reuven do? That's the burning question that the sages occupy themselves with in Masechet Shabbos, in Tractate Shabbos, in the Gemara. Because to say that Reuven actually did, as the Pasuk seems to indicate that he did, which is that he committed both incest and adultery with his father's wife, Bilha, his father's concubine, Bilha, would be, number one, shocking. Number two, would not be consistent with the very next list in the Chumash. Because the very next thing that the Chumash does is it lists the 12 sons of Yaakov as if they are all equal. In fact, it emphasizes Bechor Yaakov Reuven, the firstborn of Yaakov, is Reuven. So here our sages exercise their insight, and they tell us, Kol ha'omer Reuven chata, eino ela toa. Anybody who says Reuven sinned is only making a mistake. Now they do not mean to say that Reuven did not commit a sin. Reuven did commit a sin, and he suffers a consequence for this sin, as we will talk about this evening. What they mean to say is that although the Torah seems to accuse Reuven of a terrible sin, that is a mistake to think that the Torah means that Reuven actually committed this sin. So then the question becomes, what did he really do? And if in fact he didn't do what the Torah says he did, why does the Torah trick us and tell us that he did something worse than he actually did? So the number one thing is to find out what did he do, and then to understand why the Torah presents it in this way. So what did he do? Let us skip ahead to yesterday's Parsha Vayechi, where we will see what he really did, and we will also see the consequence he suffered for what he did. So hold the place on page 190 and turn
That's right. 274.
Ellen, you get a Mazel Tov too, right? Mazel Tov. Do you want to share your Mazel Tov before we... But not everybody knows about it. You have one also?
I have a grandson.
Mazel Tov.
Mazel
Tov. Wow. Wow. Wow, Mazel Tov. And Ellen, your daughter became a caller, right?
Mazel Tov. She hasn't gotten married yet.
Mazel Tov. Mazel Tov. Wow. Okay. Anybody else?
Baby boy.
No, I don't know. Okay. So on page 274, we have Yaakov giving blessings to his children before he dies. And he starts with Reuven. So in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, Reuven Bechori Ata, Reuven, you are my firstborn, Kochi, my strength, Vereshis Oni, and the first of my strength, they translated it as vigor, because they wanted to use a word other than strength, because it would seem redundant to say strength twice. But it's another word for strength. Yeser Se'es V'yeser Uz, they translate it as foremost in rank and foremost in power. Pachas Kamayim, water like impetuously. You were impetuous like water. Al Tosar, you will not be foremost. Ki Alisa Mishkeve Avicha, for you. Now here's the translation here is you mounted your father's bed. Alisa actually means you lifted up. You lifted up your father's bed. Az chilalta yitzui Allah. Then you desecrated him who ascends my couch. So Reuven lifted his father's bed. That is what he did. So what does that mean, he lifted his father's bed? So our sages explain that Rachel had just died. Now we know that Yaakov had four wives, Rachel and Leah, and Bilhah and Zilpah. And we also know that Yaakov's main wife was Rachel. Leah had the most children, but Rachel was his main wife, because the whole reason why Yaakov ended up with Laban in the first place, which is why he ended up marrying Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, was because of Rachel. If it wasn't good for Rachel, Yaakov would have moved on someplace else. He never would have stayed there in the first place. So it's all because of Rachel that he was there, that he ended up with any of his wives. So she was the Ikaras Habayis, she was the main wife. And therefore, although Yaakov did split his time amongst his four wives, but he was primarily in Rachel's tent. That was his main place of his four wives. When Rachel died, Reuven felt that the appropriate thing for Yaakov to do would now to make Leah his primary wife. Because, okay, Rachel is number one, it's that he accepted that. But once Rachel dies, well, Leah should be second. Bilhah and Zilpah are only the maids, and therefore Leah should be next in line. But Yaakov didn't do that. Yaakov instead moved his bed, which would be his main place of living, to Bilhah's tent, the maid of Rachel. That's where he made his primary residence. Not Leah's tent, but Bilhah's tent. And Reuven took very great exception to this move on Yaakov's part. The way our sages express it is, Reuven said, it was bad enough that my mother's sister should be a tzara, should be a co-wife to my mother. My mother's sister should supersede my mother. But the maid of my mother's sister should supersede my mother? That was too much to bear. And so Reuven felt that what his father had done was wrong. Now, at that point, all is okay. It is acceptable for a son to disagree with what his father does. That's fine. In fact, the Gemara in Kedushin explains to us, when the Gemara is discussing how to properly conduct oneself in the mitzvah of kibud avim, of honoring one's parents, how does one correct a parent? There's a way to do it and a way not to do it. We all know that we have to give honor to our parents. On the other hand, if our parents are making a mistake, we do need to correct them. But there is a respectful way to correct, and there is a disrespectful way to correct. And you understand that with a parent, the threshold between disrespect and respect is much higher. One has to be much more careful in how one corrects a parent. It's a very difficult challenge. And all of us who have been there, it's a very, very difficult thing to do to correct parents in the appropriate manner. Here, Reuven reacted improperly. What he did is he made a statement. He didn't say anything to his father. He didn't yell. He didn't scream. He didn't say anything disrespectful. What he did is he picked up his father's bed. His father wasn't in it at the time. It was during the day. He picked up his father's bed and moved it from Bilhah's tent into Leah's tent. He made a statement. So that when Yaakov would come home and look in Bilhah's tent and not see his bed and go looking for it and find it in Leah's tent, then he would get the message. That is what Reuven did to make his point. That is what he did wrong. Because that was too strong a point to make. He could have made his point in a way that was more respectful. This was considered disrespect. Now, why was it disrespectful? He didn't say anything. He didn't speak in a disrespectful manner. He didn't even speak in a strong way. He didn't speak at all. Why was this disrespectful? What was wrong? Was it really disrespectful? Would we say this is a disrespectful thing to do? Why was it wrong for him to move his father's bed from one tent to the other?
Embarrassment.
To whom?
To Yaakov and the wives.
Okay, so one suggestion is this caused embarrassment.
Because it caused his place to decide where his father should be. It's none of his business.
Okay, it's none of his business. None of his business to decide. Well,
you don't,
in privacy,
a difference of opinion, you don't make a reaction without trying to express it to the other individual.
Okay. Evidently, Reuven felt this was his way of expressing it.
Right, but that is not the way. If you have a disagreement, you don't move and do something that is not agreeable to the other party.
Okay.
Without discussing it first.
Okay. So he didn't.
That's wrong.
Okay, he didn't speak first. It could be he felt that if he would speak, he wouldn't speak properly. It could be this was his way of avoiding saying something disrespectful.
The equivalent would be, if your wife is doing something that you didn't like, you don't give her money, rather than tell her you don't like it.
That's
what?
Okay, wait, I have to think about that one.
I think you're pushing it a little.
It would seem to me that Reuven was deliberately not speaking because speaking he might have said something wrong. And whether it was his business, he was coming to protect his mother, as he felt that Yaakov. Let's first examine it a little differently. Why did Yaakov move his bed into Bilhah's tent rather than Leah's tent? Why would he pick Bilhah over Leah? Over Leah?
She was taking care of the children.
Okay, so partially because Bilhah is Rachel's servant, so it's sort of like Rachel still there. Mm-hmm. And also because Bilhah raises Binyamin, who is a newborn, and she, Rachel died in childbirth. So Binyamin is a newborn. Bilhah is going to raise him, and Yosef is only 8 years old. So Bilhah becomes the stepmother for Rachel's children. So Yaakov therefore feels Bilhah is the place where he should be. Reuven is not discounting that. That's a valid cheshbon. That's a valid calculation. But Reuven feels that's insulting to Leah, and that Yaakov is misreading just how insulting that will be to his mother Leah. So Reuven is trying to make a point that, okay, there's one thing to think about, which is Bilhah's raising the children, and Bilhah is, like Rachel, still there, but Leah is going to be insulted. And so he moves the bed.
You know, sometimes it's worse to do something than to speak about it.
If you're confident that when you speak you will be able to control yourself and maintain your way of speaking, then it's better to speak. But if you're afraid that when you speak you may overreact, you may do something wrong, perhaps an action is better. Because I don't know. I don't know if Reuven felt that way or not. But the point that Reuven is taking the task for is not so much that he did something, but it's what he did.
It's a totally private matter.
Right. I mean, yeah. Because his father's bed is his father's business. He can speak to him about it. He can do something else about it. But to move his father's bed was touching a very private matter. And that's something that a son should not be involved with. And that's why Reuven is taking the task.
Rabbi, I can't imagine a parent having four wives with different children and trying to compromise with all the problems that would result as a result. It had to be horrible.
Although we know from the Torah that it is permitted for a man to take more than one wife, the Gemara makes it clear it was a very rare thing, and it was only done when if a man had the resources to do it. Then, as number one, it was only for the wealthy, because he had to be able to support several families. That's obviously, you know, that's number one. But number two, it's clear that it was something that was reserved for those who were able to juggle that sort of situation, which is obviously very difficult. And as we know already, back in the 10th century, Rabbeinu Gershom outlawed it, and we no longer do it. That's why it's prohibited for us today, because Rabbeinu Gershom, who was the head of all of Ashkenazic Jewry, outlawed it back then, and that's binding for all of us today. That's why it's not done, and it is actually prohibited. Sfaradim were not bound by that decree, which is why you still can find in some remote Sfaradi communities that it is possible to be done. But for Ashkenazim, it is prohibited. But that's exactly what you're saying, because the ability to be able to do it properly was lost long ago. When Reuven did this, Reuven was, as the Torah calls it, impetuous, as it says in Parashas Vayechi on page 276 and 277. He was pachas kamayim, water-like impetuous. Impetuosity. Thank you. So he was too quick to react. Because of this, Reuven loses some very special rights that he had. Reuven was the firstborn. As the firstborn, as it says on page 274-275, it says, Yeser Se'es V'Yeser Uz, which means foremost in rank and foremost in power. As Rashi explains to us, Yeser Se'es, foremost in rank, is a reference to being the Kohen. Because the word Se'es, which means to lift up, is associated with Nesias Kapayim, which is the lifting of the palms to bless the Jewish people, which is what the Kohanim do. That's Duchening. That's what Reuven would have had he not sinned. Yeser Uz, which refers to strength and power, that is a reference to the royalty. As we say, V'yitein Oz L'malko, give strength to his king. to David HaMelech. Royalty would have come from Reuven. Reuven would have been both the ancestor of the Kohanim and the ancestor of the kings of the dynasty of Israel. But because he acted this way, he lost both. Because a leader, above all, cannot be impetuous. A leader must consider before he reacts. A leader must think things through before taking action. And the way that Reuven reacted was considered to be too quick, and therefore he lost these very special gifts that were his. That's the consequence for what he did. But the Torah expresses it as he went and he lived with his father's concubine, Bilhah. Why would the Torah express it that way? What's that?
We're back, yeah.
Back on page 190. Back where we are. 191. That's where it says, Vayelech Reuven, Vayishkaves Bilhah Pilageshavit. And he slept with, he lived with Bilhah, the concubine of his father, in verse 22. Pasuk Chav Beis. Now, why would the Torah express it that way? That's pretty harsh. If all he did was move the bed, that's a pretty harsh thing to say. And this is a pretty stiff accusation. Somebody committing adultery with his father's wife, that's more than just overreacting. That's acting the lowest of the low do that. So why would the Torah express it this way? In fact, it's striking because, not this week, but next week when we get into the children of Esav, we will see all kinds of incest and adultery and all kinds of various strange and just fairly disgusting relationships that are going to go on. But the Torah only speaks about it in remez, only as a hint, only through veiled expression. It does not say anything explicitly. The Torah doesn't like to talk about these things.
Rabbi, you say that he slept with his father's concubine, and then later you refer to it as his wife, as his father's
wife. Okay, good question. Good.
I mean,
why is she called a concubine?
Would be a wife.
Right.
That's my question.
But why is she called a concubine over here?
Right.
A concubine means a sub wife. A concubine is a wife that does not have a kesuba, does not have a marriage contract, which is prohibited for most people. A king is allowed to take a pilagesh, is allowed to take a concubine. Most everybody else cannot. So why is she referred to as a pilagesh? Pilagesh sounds like she's not a real wife.
But if a king had 20 concubines, does that mean he has 20 wives?
They don't have the same status as a wife. They are still prohibited to anybody else.
All right.
But the reason why here she's referred to as a concubine is because Reuven treated her as a concubine. And Reuven's point was, she's not a real wife. My mother Leah is a real wife. You should go to my mother Leah, not to Bilhah. So Reuven treated her as if she doesn't count. So Reuven considered her to be a secondary wife. And that's why she's called a Pilagesh. But why does the Torah accuse him of actually living with her when he did not? So our sages explain that what he did was tantamount to living with her, because he took his father away from her. Now, not that she actually wasn't with him, because it was discovered and everything was put back to the way it was, but he was attempting to take his father away from her. We find the same thing later on in history, when the sons of Eli was the Kohen Gadol in the time of the judges, at the very end of the period of the judges, right before Shmuel becomes the main prophet of Israel. At that time, Eli had two sons, Hophni and Pinchas. Hophni and Pinchas were both great and righteous people. Yet the prophet tells us that the women who would come to the temple to offer sacrifices, they would live with those women. That's what the prophet tells us they did. They lived with the women who came to offer sacrifices. Again, the Gemara tells us, Kol ha'omer b'nei Eli chatu, anybody who says the sons of Eli sinned, eino ela toa, is only making a mistake. It's the same explanation. Not that they didn't sin, they did sin. But they didn't do what the prophet is telling us they did. What, in fact, did they do? This is what they did. The women were coming to offer a sacrifice. You may know that in the time of the temple, when a woman bears a child, they need to go to the temple to offer a sacrifice. That is the law. Every time a woman has a baby, they offer a sacrifice at the temple after a certain amount of days. It's after 40 days after having a boy, after 80 days from having a girl, they offer a sacrifice. Now, the women would travel to the temple. If they, no matter where they were living in Israel, they would have to travel to the temple. Well, that, you know, that could be a several-day trip. They go to the temple, and they offer the sacrifice. When the sacrifice was offered, the women could give it to the Kohen. A woman could give her sacrifice to the Kohen, and then leave and go home. But the righteous women didn't want to leave until their sacrifice was actually offered. They wanted to see it being done. You didn't have to do that. You could have just given it over to the Kohen and gone home, and whenever they would get to it, they would get to it. But the women were righteous, and they wanted to see their sacrifice actually offered. And so the women would wait around. Chafni and Pinchas, who were in charge of the Beis HaMikdash, allowed there to be a backlog. They didn't get to the sacrifices right away. They would get to it. Yeah, we'll get to it eventually. They were busy with this, busy with that, etc. And as a result, they would delay the women in Jerusalem. And the women wouldn't go home because they were waiting for the sacrifice to be brought. And as a result, they kept the women from their husbands. Because the women weren't necessarily with their husbands. Imagine, they just had a baby. Husband is working. Husband can't necessarily take off time to come with their wife. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a regular occurrence in Israel. There are other children at home. It could be the husband had to stay. You know, it wasn't like the husbands were necessarily with their wives. So the wives would be traveling alone and in Jerusalem, and now they're waiting for the sacrifice to be brought. And because Hophni and Pinchas wouldn't get to them quickly, they would delay the women in Jerusalem longer than they had to be there and keep them from their husbands. Says the prophet, that is called living with the women. Keeping a woman from her husband is tantamount to adultery. That's what is being said. Now, it's not actual adultery, but it is, in effect, it is in effect separating a husband and a wife. Coming between a husband and a wife. That is what was going on with Chafni and Pinchas. That is what is going on here with Reuven. He is stepping between Bilhah and Yaakov. That is tantamount to committing adultery with Bilhah. It is preventing her from being with her husband Yaakov. That's what he's being accused of. Now, okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
How do the prophets determine, after reading in the Torah, and that's their interpretation?
I'm going to show you.
Where do they get that?
Yeah, I'm going to show you how we know this.
Yeah.
I'll show you that in a minute. Let me just finish this first, and I'll show you that. That's the next step. How do they know?
All right.
We're going to get that. Does anybody want to volunteer to shut the heat? Thank you. I'm sorry. I'll stall.
You're talking
about
the husband and wife in God.
Correct.
You're really discounting that. And that's
fair. Okay. I mean, Reuven was setting up his father with another one of his wives. It wasn't like he was... Okay. Okay. The Torah doesn't accuse him of doing something which wasn't his business, but moving a bed was getting involved in something which was personal.
Is it significant at all that Reuven was also involved with the Dudaim, which separated...
Oh, that's interesting. That he was the one who brought the Dudaim, which ended up separating Rachel from... Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, he didn't
know that was...
Yeah, that was he just brought to his mother, and that's what happened from there. But that's interesting. Interesting point. Now, why would the Torah call that... we're explaining why it's called adultery. But still, it seems kind of harsh. So here we have to understand that, and we've talked about this before, that the great ones are held to a very high standard. The great ones, we know that Chazal tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is medaktekim chasidav, Hashem is, he is exacting with the very righteous ones, kechut hasaira, like a hair's breadth. Which means that if they deviate even a little bit from the straight and narrow, they get punished. That's why when Moshe, all he did was he hit the rock, instead of speaking to the rock, he can't go into Israel. It's a pretty harsh punishment for what Moshe did. When we get to that story, we'll discuss it. But because he did such a, even a slight thing, he gets punished. When Avraham Avinu, we already learned about this, when he said to Hashem, Bama Eda Ki'i Rashana, how will I know that I'll get the land of Israel? When Hashem told him you'll get it, but he says, but how will I know? Because he questioned, therefore he was punished that his children would have to end up slaves in Egypt. It's a pretty harsh punishment for simply saying, how will I know? But the great ones, when they deviate even slightly from perfection, then there is a consequence. Moreover, the Torah will use a very harsh description of what they did. Because on their level, what they did is tantamount to this sin. What Reuven did was he moved a bed. But because of his greatness, he was, after all, Reuven. He was one of the most righteous people in the world at the time. Because he should have known better, therefore the Torah describes what he did in such a harsh manner. Because what Reuven did, moving a bed, is tantamount to some lowlife committing adultery. If any of us would move our father's bed, it may be wrong. The Torah would never describe that as committing adultery, because we're not expected to be on the level of Reuven. And therefore the Torah will, quote-unquote, cut us some slack. We may be wrong, we may even be punished, God forbid. But the Torah would never describe it as committing adultery. But when Reuven moves his father's bed, the Torah says, Reuven committed adultery.
But Rabbi, when you get to the preliminary portions where the Torah talks about a son killing another son,
mm-hmm.
where does that, their definition may not be exact? It may be what you're saying.
No, I haven't answered your question yet. You want to know, but how do we know?
Yeah,
I'm still getting to that. We're getting to it. One more point to make before we get to that.
Yeah.
That is also the same thing when, hopefully we'll get to it at some point or other, the famous story of King David with Bathsheba, where David is accused of committing adultery. There it is the same thing. Of course David HaMelech did not commit adultery. That's clear if you read the verses over there, and you read it understanding what the verses are saying, it is obvious that he did not commit adultery. And hopefully we'll have a chance to learn that story, and we will show the misunderstanding that is made, and how obvious it is that he did not commit adultery. Nevertheless, what he did on his level is tantamount to someone on a much lower level committing adultery. Therefore, he is described as committing adultery. But Herman is asking, how do we know? So I will show you here how we know, and the other stories we'll have to wait till we get there to show how we know those other stories. The way we know it over here is because, and I already alluded to this before, but I want you to notice the trup. The trup are the cantillations, which is the tune. Of the words in Pasuk Chaf Beis in 22. Now I know that not everybody around the table knows how to read cantillations, and I have no intention of teaching it this evening, nor of singing it for you. However, you do know that there are certain symbols which connote certain types of tunes, certain types of cantillations. Now, those cantillations, that trup, is more than just a tune. That is the punctuation of the Torah. The Torah we know that in the Torah itself, if you open up a Torah scroll, there are no vowels, and there is no punctuation. Where does the verse start? Where does the verse end? Where are the commas? Nothing. It just reads. And that's all Torah Sheva'al Peh. It's the oral Torah that tells us the vowels, and that tells us where the verse starts and ends, and where the commas are. How do you break up each verse? How do you know that when it says, Lo Tirtzach, which means don't murder, that the way you read it is, Lo, no, Tirtzach, murder. Whereas my father always likes to say, No, turn on red. Right? How do you know? That has to do with the trup. That has to do with the cantillations. The cantillations is the oral Torah, the Torah Sheva'al Peh, that tells us how to break up the phrases of each verse. And different punctuations, different cantillations, are either connectors or they are pauses. Each one, although we know the tunes perhaps, but they're meant to be more than tunes. They are either pauses or they are connectors. There are 8 trups that are connectors. The rest of them are pauses. But the pauses are further broken up into 4 groups, each with a different level of pausing. It's not so simple to read from the Torah. Most Torah readers don't know all of these nuances. That's why it's hard to find a really, really expert Torah reader, because these nuances are actually difficult to know. And when one reads, if one is really going to do it right, one has to pause different amounts of time depending on the type of cantillation.
There's still only 4 pauses?
There's 4 different categories of the length of pause, and the 5th category are connectors. So it's a total of 5 categories. The most significant pauses are, of course, Sof Pasuk, which means the end of the verse. That's obviously a significant pause. And in that same category is the Esnachta. The Esnachta is otherwise known as the wishbone, which I will show you what one looks like. Okay, look in verse 21. Verse 21, Chaf Aleph, the second line on the Hebrew side, second to last word on the line is Yisrael. If you look underneath the Aleph, there are 2 dots, which is the A sound, and there is also that wishbone. That wishbone is the Esnachta. The Esnachta is the most significant pause in the verse. If you're going to break the verse up into 2, then half the verse will be before the Esnachta, and the second half of the verse will be after the Esnachta. That is the most significant pause in the verse. And the other ones, so, as I said, some of them are connectors, and some of them are pauses of different lengths.
Is that line next to the Esnachta?
What's that?
The line. Yeah, in Israel.
I'm not sure. I don't see a line next to it.
Which one? Oh, he's looking at the end of Chafbeis.
Yeah, we'll get to Chafbeis. Not to Chafbeis. I'm in Chafalos. Okay, now. Yeah, I'll get to that later. Now, just to give you an example of how this works, look at Chafalos. Look at 21. At 21, I'm going to read the verse. 21 has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words in it. It has Vayisa Yisrael Vayet Ahalo Mehala Lemigdal Eder. And Yisrael traveled and he pitched his tent further than Migdal Eder. So the way, I'm not going to sing it for you, but I'll tell you the pauses. Vayisa is a minor pause. Yisrael is a major pause. So it's Vayisa Yisrael.
So the pause is after the word because...
Yeah. That's right. It tells you to pause after, read the word and then pause.
Oh.
Correct. That's correct. So, Vayisa is a minor pause, Yisrael is a major pause. Vayet is a connector. That goes together with Ahalo. Vayet Ahalo. There should be no pause between those 2 words, which means then he pitched his tent. The trup on the word Ahalo, which is above the Lamed, is a minor pause. Vayet Ahalo. So those 2 words go together, but with a minor pause. Mehala is another minor pause, and Lemigdal Eder goes together. That's easy to see. There's a dash between the 2 words. So that's how you break up that verse. And as I said, tonight we're not going to go through all of it. We could have a class about cantillations, but that is the way you break up that one.
Is there a name for the dash that connects to Lemigdal?
Yeah, that's called a makkah. Now, dash. Now, the next one, 22, Chaf Beis, this is the one we need to focus on. The beginning of the verse is pretty standard. Vayehi, and it was, that's a minor pause. Bishkon Yisrael, Bishkon is a connector, Yisrael is a minor pause. So Bishkon Yisrael means when Yisrael dwelled. Ba'aretz Hahi, Ba'aretz is a connector, Hahi is a minor pause, in that land. Now, here's where it begins to get interesting. Starting with the word Vayelech, well, Vayelech has a connector on it. I feel like I'm talking about the 285. And right. Vayelech has a connector on it. And after that, the words, uncharacteristically, have double cantillations. Each word has two cantillations on it. Now, I realize if you're not familiar with cantillations, it's hard to see how there are two. But if you look at the word Reuven, above the vase, there's really two different cantillations there. On the word Vayishkav, there's one over the cuff and one over the vase.
Looks like two over the cuff.
No, that's why, as I said, that's really one. I know, it looks like two, but that's really one. Yeah. That's one, and then the one over the vase is another one.
Yeah,
if you look at Bilha, underneath the first hay there's one, above the second hay there's another one. Pilegesh, like that one only has one, that's a connector. Then on the word Aviv, on the vase, there's one below it and one above it. Vayishma only has one. Yisrael has two. Underneath the Aleph, there's two. So why are there two different cantillations? And the answer is because there's two ways to read this verse. One set of cantillations puts the wishbone, as I said, that's the major pause in the verse, under the word Aviv. And it puts the Sof Pasuk, the end of the verse, under Yisrael. Under the Aleph of Yisrael, you notice, there's a wishbone and a line. That line connotes the end of the verse. You can't have two wishbones in the verse, because the wishbone always means this is the major's pause in the verse. You can only have one wishbone. One esnachta. So, here you have two. You have one under Aviv, and one under Yisrael. Because really only one of them is meant to be read. One way of reading it is that Aviv ends the first half of the verse, Yisrael ends the second half of the verse. So the way you would read it is, this is the one way of reading it, Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went, Vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv, and he lived with Bilha, the concubine of his father, pause, major pause, Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael heard, end of verse. That's one way to read it. Second way to read it is, no, that the esnachta, the major pause, is under the word Yisrael, which appears to be the last word in the verse. If that's so, then the verse continues. It's not the end of the verse. And in fact, the end of the verse is after the next verse, Vayuvnei Yaakov Shnei Masar, and the sons of Yaakov were 12, meaning verses 22 and 23 are actually one verse, not two. And the way you would read it in that case is, Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went, Vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv, and he lived with Bilha, the concubine of his father, Vayishma Yisrael heard, major pause. Rest of the verse is, Vayuvnei Yaakov Shnei Masar, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. That's the two ways of reading it. And what's interesting is that one way keeps them as two separate verses, the other way joins them into one verse. The two are one. Why would there be a way of reading it that puts them together? And why would there be two ways? This is Torah Shebaal Peh. This is the oral Torah telling us that there's two appropriate ways to read this verse. And as our sages explain, what the oral Torah is telling us with these two ways of reading the verse is that there is this simple way, which is that these are two verses. Reuven did a terrible sin, his father heard about it. End of verse. The other way to read it is, Reuven did his sin, his father heard about it, but the sons of Yaakov were still 12. Don't think that Reuven did something that would have thrown him out of being one of the 12 tribes. Reuven remains one of the 12 tribes despite what he did. In other words, he couldn't have done what it says literally he did. Because had he done what it says that he did, he would have been discounted from the 12. He would have forever been excluded from the 12. Because if someone does something like that, they can't possibly be one of the 12 tribes. They could still be a good person. Anybody can do teshuvah. A person can repent. But one of the 12 tribes, who is meant to be one of the great leaders of the Jewish people, that writes them off. Once someone does something that egregious, then they are lost to being a great leader. And so Reuven here, from the fact that the Torah has another way of reading it, which runs the two together, what the Torah is saying is, whoa, be careful. Reuven is still one of the 12. It goes together. He was never discounted from being one of the 12. Now, he does have a consequence, as we said. He does lose out. And he no longer can be the greatest of the 12. He cannot be the ancestor of the Kohen Gadol. He cannot be the ancestor of the Melech of the king. That he loses. Because even if he didn't do what the Torah says he did, but he still did something wrong, he acted impetuously, which does preclude him from being the ancestor of Kohen Gadol and king. However, had he done literally what the Torah says, he would have been discounted completely. That's how we know that what he did, as the Gemara says, Eino Ela Toa, one who thinks that he did what the Torah says he did, is making a mistake. Yes?
So, based on the fact that I think all of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the 12 tribes, we learn, you know, who we are, essentially. Because he acted out of passion, out of anger. You know,
okay.
So I think he repented, right?
He did repent.
And he remained one of the... So that in us, you know, that instant, you know, let's kill him, let's...
Well, this is only 1/12. It's not all of us.
No, but, you know, we're multifaceted people, mm-hmm. with hot tempered stupid. The fact that Joseph could control himself,
mm-hmm.
the fact that Reuben made this mistake and then repented, those are the roots of our people.
And okay, okay.
So what I'm trying to say is that that kind of was the medicine for us, you know, for the future, you know, like we don't have that. Like I would think the Arabs are more the people that act, you know, violently, very quickly. And, you know, because we have this as a forefather and we have him repenting, we don't have it as much. This is the root of our heritage.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Very nice. Very nice. Now, notice two other things we have to notice over here. One is, and I alluded to this before, what is this focus on where they were? In Chaf Aleph in 21, it says, Yisrael traveled, and he pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. Where is that? And it was when he pitched it, when he lived in that place, Reuven went and did this. What's the focus on where they were? That's number one. Number two, this is a fascinating set of verses because the name Yisrael is used and not Yaakov. It says, Vayisa Yisrael, Yisrael traveled, and he pitched his tent, etc. And it was when Yisrael was living in that place, and Reuven did this, and Yisrael heard. Three times, the name Yisrael is used, and then right away the next verse, Vayu b'nei Yaakov, Shnei Masar. The sons of Yaakov were 12. Well, are we calling him Yisrael, or are we calling him Yaakov? And again, after the 12 sons are listed, then it says at the end of Pasuk Chav Vav 26, Ela b'nei Yaakov. These are the sons of Yaakov. And the next pasuk, Vayavo Yaakov el Yitzchak. Yaakov comes to Yitzchak. So, why switch? What, we're talking about Yisrael, we're talking about Yaakov. If you look in pasuk Chav, verse 20, that precedes this story, with when Yaakov puts up the monument at Kever Rachel, it says Vayatsev Yaakov Matseva, uses the name Yaakov, he puts up the monument. Yet, with the story of Reuven, it is the name Yisrael that is used. Why is the name Yisrael used rather than the name Yaakov when dealing with the story of Reuven? And what is the focus on the place beyond Migdal Eder, and that he was in that place?
To camouflage his name, so that nobody should know who he is.
Well, we know who Yisrael is. I mean, we had that before, the Torah tells us. It wasn't too long ago that his name had been changed from Yaakov to Yisrael, or that he was given another name, Yisrael. So we know, I mean, and then the Torah calls us B'nai Yisrael, so we know who we are. Right?
The name is one more personal and the other national.
Okay, good. Which one is personal, which one is national?
Yaakov is personal.
Okay, and how do we know Yisrael is national?
When you're talking to the
B'nai Yisrael,
when you're talking to your sons, it's national.
No,
when
I
you,
don't think so.
But when you're talking on otherwise, it's not.
Okay. You see, just the opposite. Mm-hmm. All right. Where is this Migdal Eder? Migdal Eder has another. It comes up another time in Scripture, in Tanakh. It comes up in the book of Micah, which is one of Treyaser, one of the 12 smaller prophets. And in Perek Dalet, fourth chapter of Micha, Pasuk Ches, verse 8.
It's not in there.
I brought it with me here. It's in the book of Micha, in Micah. So we don't have it in front of us. So in chapter 4, verse 8, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Ches, it says, Ve'ata Migdal Eder, and you, Migdal Eder, Ophel Bas Tzion, the hidden one of Bas Tzion, Adecha Seseh. Your beauty will come forth, will be gathered to you. Uba HaMemshala HaRishona, and the first kingship will come back. Mamleches Levas Yerushalayim, the kingdom to Bas Yerushalayim. These verses here in Micha are talking about, as the pasuk says over here, it's talking about Acharis Hayamim, in the future, after Mashiach comes, and royalty comes back to the Jewish people, and the exiles are ingathered, and the 10 tribes that were taken into exile first are restored to the Jewish people, all 12 tribes together. Then it refers to Migdal Eder. And the commentaries here tell us Migdal Eder, Migdal means a tower, and Eder could mean
a flock?
No. A flock is what it could mean, yeah. The tower of the flock. Some say it refers to the Beis HaMikdash. Some say it refers to Yerushalayim. Some say it refers to the king himself. Whatever it is, it's a reference to the future and to the restoration of the Jewish people in Yerushalayim with the Beis HaMikdash, with the king. Yaakov was traveling and he pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. He is right in the vicinity of Migdal Eder, which you understand, he's right before Hebron. He's going to Hebron to his father. Hebron is a little bit south of Jerusalem, of Yerushalayim. He's in the vicinity. That's where he is. So he pitches his tent right in the area, right around Migdal Eder, which is near, take your pick, the Beis HaMikdash, Yerushalayim, where the king is going to reside, which is also right near the Beis HaMikdash. He's in the ballpark. He's around there. Now, that it's not called Migdal Eder yet. Migdal Eder is something in the future. Yet the Torah here refers to his place as Migdal Eder, which means the Torah is telling us, I want to call your attention to the future. The story you're about to read, the Torah says in Pasuk Chaf Aleph 21, Vayisa Yisrael, Yisrael traveled using the name of Yaakov that connotes something eternal. Yisrael, something broader, something bigger. We're about to discuss a story which has universal implications, has timeless implications. We're about to talk about a story which is not local. We're going to use the name Yisrael, not Yaakov. And where did he travel to? He pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. Migdal Eder, that ought to conjure up in our minds, if we were familiar with Scripture, which unfortunately we're not. But if we would be, then it would all of a sudden we would think, Migdal Eder, we're talking the future. We're talking Mashiach. We're talking Beis HaMikdash. We're talking Yerushalayim. That's what the Torah is kind of focusing us on when we're about to start this story. And what happened? And it was when Yisrael was dwelling in that land, Reuven went and did what he did. And Yisrael heard about it. The Torah is telling us what we already mentioned before. What happened in this story has a major, major consequence. Can you imagine? So we've cleaned up what Reuven did. That's fine. But can you imagine the consequence? Reuven could have been the ancestor of the Kohen Gadol and of the kings. Mashiach would have come from Reuven. Mashiach is the descendant of King David. He's a king. Reuven, the Beis HaMikdash, could have been his to run as the Kohen Gadol, his descendants. And because of this episode, that eternity is lost to him. He remains one of the 12 tribes. He remains in eternity as part of the Jewish people. But he loses those two special gifts, which anybody would have wanted to have. That is why the Torah uses Yisrael, which connotes the universal name of Yaakov, and also that it refers us to Migdal Eder. Yes?
Does that have an effect? It must have an effect on us today. That everything could have come from.
That's correct. Okay, so this. Okay, what Mrs. Winberg is bringing up, which is very important, and it refers back to a class I gave not in this a long time ago in this forum, which is that, and we can only reference it now. We can't really talk about it now. We'll see next time. I'm not sure if we'll focus on this or not, but remember that Shem, the son of Noach, had all three crowns in one place. The crown of Torah, the crown of Kahuna, and the crown of Malchus, of royalty. He had all three. Amongst us, they are necessarily split. The crown of Torah, anybody can wear. But the crown of royalty and the crown of Kahuna, I always say, is a family business. If you come from Aaron, you're a Kohen. If you don't, you're not. If you come from David, you can be a king. If you don't, you can't. David is from Yehuda. Aaron is from Levi. It's split. Only Levi can produce the Kohen. Only Yehuda can produce the king. Not in one tribe. Reuven had them together, just as Shem had them together. And because of this, there is a split. They become separate entities. And that is very significant.
Does that water it down a little
bit? I wouldn't say waters it down. It's what they always say in the financial markets. It diversifies.
That tells you.
Well, that tells us that it had to become diversified. Where until this point, it could have existed in one person. And now it can't. Which means that there is a fear in it residing in one person. A person can wear two of the three crowns at the same time. A person can be the Kohen and also the greatest Torah scholar of the generation. We have that several times throughout Scripture. A good example is Yehoyada, the Kohen Gadol. He was both the greatest Torah scholar of the generation and he was the Kohen Gadol. A person can be the king and the greatest Torah scholar of the generation. And the most famous example of that is David HaMelech. King David was both the king and the greatest Torah scholar of his generation. But one cannot have all three at the same time. No longer. Once you have this episode, it splits it.
So
and that's a major thing.
Huh? So then God set it up? I mean, it was kind of a setup.
Well, it wasn't a setup. I mean, Reuven made a choice over here. Reuven made a choice.
Was there anybody who did that? Wasn't there somebody who did it and it was a mistake? Or
no? Yeah. Well, that's the unfortunate... Not Shaul. Well, there were a couple of kings throughout. There were a couple of kings who tried to become prince. But the real tragic. It's right. It's the tragic end to the Hashmonaim. And in the Hanukkah story, the Maccabees in the end, that was their tragic mistake. In the next generation, they who were the Kohanim also tried to be the kings, and as a result, they were punished severely. Because they violated this point. But this is not the verse that tells you that it's prohibited. Later on, we'll find the verse that says prohibited. But that's what they did. That is something which cannot be done anymore. Okay, so we still... I'm not sure if next time we'll touch on this point a little bit more. But we still need to cover Yaakov coming to Yitzchak and Yitzchak's death and being buried by Yaakov and Esav. That we have not covered this evening.